So I think that, you know, there is a view, and it's one that I have, that, you know, you would trade a little bit less efficiency for rewarding and prosperous middle-class jobs that support American families, that support income mobility, and that support a vibrant middle class. And that if you define that as an end state, then you would look at outsourcing and find it in most times to be problematic.
Hello, I'm Oren Kass, Executive Director at American Compass, and welcome to the American Compass podcast. On this episode, we're delighted to present a conversation between Washington Free Beacon editor Aaron Severium and investor Sam Long on the financialization of the American economy, the culture of high finance, and business meritocracy. Please enjoy the episode and check out more of our work at americancompass.org.
Hello, my name is Aaron Severium. I am a member of American Compass, and I have the great honor and privilege of hosting the inaugural episode of the American Compass podcast. My guest today is Sam Long, who is a small business investor. And today we are going to talk about private equity, meritocracy, the financialization of the economy, and all sorts of other wonderful topics. So, Sam, welcome.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be with you and excited to be doing the first podcast.
Yeah. So I guess to start, could you just tell me a little bit about your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined the Marine Corps after graduating from the Naval Academy about 11 years ago now. I spent 5 years as an infantry officer in the Marines, bounced all over the world, which included deployments to places like Korea, time aboard a Navy warship in the Pacific, a tour as a combat advisor to the Army of the Republic of Georgia, and then some time in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, and had a phenomenal 5 years in the Marines. Left the Marine Corps and started my private sector career, where I got very interested in entrepreneurship and small business, and spent a couple of years, you know, looking at small companies and investing in small companies in the energy sector before going to business school, and have continued, you know, this, you know, small business investor career where I sit today in a role where I spend a lot of time helping young entrepreneurs who are looking to buy companies. And so I spend a lot of time looking at various markets and various small businesses and have a lot of fun doing so.
So you're in finance, I mean, very broadly.
That's right.
And in 2019, you wrote an essay called The Financialization of the American Elite, in which you essentially criticized your own profession. Could you tell me a little bit about that essay?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a long form piece that I, like, as you said, published in American Affairs. And, you know, I think the goal was not to declare that finance was bad, nor to declare that finance was good. And in fact, I believe it's inherently neither good nor bad, mm-hmm. but that its place of prominence in the American economy is concerning. And right. that the American economy and our business talent, which is really what the article was about, was not so much a piece about economics, but a piece about culture and business culture, has come to over-prioritize and over-reward careers in finance to the point where it punishes those who would look at careers in industry and managerial professions.
So to what extent do you think that process has affected the broader economy versus to what extent has the broader economy created the incentives that maybe encourage people to go into finance?
It's a fascinating question because the two are inextricably linked. And so I think when I think about business culture, there are a set of incentives where young people in business will pursue careers that are not just interesting to them, but that are lucrative. Right. And to your point, Aaron, you know, I think it's difficult to look at the American economy today and really fault young people who pursue careers in finance or in consulting, because that is where the money is. Right. And I think to where you're leading me, you know, the careers in industry, the careers in, you know, the real economy are just less rewarding across a number of dimensions.
Right. And before we drill into kind of the nitty gritty of the economics and the incentives, how could you maybe talk about how, if at all, being in the Marines shaped your perspective on this? Any sort of leadership lessons from the Army that you think business culture has or has not learned, and the implications for the broader economy?
You know, I think obviously they're two very different and distinct cultures, and the leadership that's required to run a corporation is different than the leadership required to lead a rifle company.
Right.
I think it was a question of expectations. You know, I think I showed up at business school expecting to be able to apply what I knew about leading, about being in front of a group of people, whether that was 40 or 150 or 1,000, and just found that it wasn't really that relevant to the modern economy, at least to the careers that it seemed like the elite business schools were pushing people towards. And that to me was, I think, the provocation for a set of questions and a set of inquiries that led me to write the American Affairs piece.
Do you think, I mean, in the popular imagination, people, I think, associate the military with a kind of meritocracy. And they also associate, I think, the financial sector, rightly or wrongly, with a kind of meritocracy. How meritocratic do you think these respective institutions are? And sort of how do you see the relationship between meritocracy on the one hand, and the growing financialization of the business elite on the other?
I came away from my military experience, on the whole, pretty impressed at the way that the military functions overall, and specifically how it thinks about rewarding and promoting talent. Now, the military is certainly not a perfect system when it comes to its human resources, but there's a clearly defined set of metrics and performance goals that most folks are able to understand and work towards. You know, I think in the private sector, and I think in finance in general, and in kind of elite culture in general, meritocracy to me seems at times to be a facade, you know, that hides a set of underlying incentives and an underlying self-interest by the people who run our corporations and who run our economy. And you know, what I found was, at least, you know, on the business school front, was that to the extent there is a culture, you know, oftentimes that culture is, you know, shareholder capitalism, you know, wrapped in meritocracy and wrapped in diversity.
Right. So do you think it's fair to say that sort of meritocracy ends up sort of reinforcing financialization, that it's kind of a justification for what is really essentially just elite dominance via finance?
It can be. I think it has gotten to that point. I don't think it has to be. You know, I think the gist of the concept is not something that I oppose. I think the implementation and the way it's used now is pretty cynical.
Could you maybe then talk about, I'll get into more specific questions in a minute, but if you had to just outline sort of 2 to 3 of your biggest critiques of finance and private equity, the way these things operate, what would they be?
Yeah, I would say that finance has gone from being an enabling and supporting function to the prime mover in the economy. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
And so when you think about the financial sector 40 or 50 years ago, you know, it was 3 or 4% of GDP, and now it's triple that. And private equity is an outgrowth of that. Again, like, I think private equity is neither good nor bad, but it is a business model that enables a set of incentives and decisions that have perverted, in aggregate, at large scale, the economy by turning America's companies into assets for financiers to generate and capture wealth rather than for financiers to provide support and enablement for companies and industry to grow and prosper.
You talk quite a bit in a lot of your essays about outsourcing. Could you just quickly say a few words about that? The relationship between sort of financialization and outsourcing.
Sure. Yeah, I think this is something that is particularly poignant given you know, we're 2 months from an election, and the regions of the United States that have borne the brunt of outsourcing are going to be the regions that decide the election. And what you've seen over the last 30 years is a set of decisions, you know, born out of a view of corporations and a view of the purpose of business that have allowed corporate managers and the shareholders that own those corporations to justify, you know, sending a lot of American jobs overseas. Goods can be produced more cheaply. And so you have this really consumer-focused view of the economy with a pretty short-term oriented culture that has had some really traumatic second and third order effects for broader American society.
In the interest of fairness, right, the counter argument that I think some people, including some Wall Street Journal columnists, will make is, well, yes, private equity does involve outsourcing, but when there's outsourcing, it makes companies more efficient, which creates wealth and surplus value. And then that gets invested in the economy, which ultimately helps everybody. What's your counter to that?
I think that the outsourcing is a choice. And the way in which you run a company is a choice. And there are certainly times when the decision to move production somewhere else is called for. You know, I think it's like it would be you know, sort of preposterous to say, you know, outsourcing writ large is bad. My reaction would be is there is immense pressure on the private sector because of financialization and because of the growing ownership of American companies, you know, by Wall Street to do that. And what you hear those people also saying out of the other corner of their mouth is you hear them demanding that the government sit on the sidelines during this process, that there is no role for the government in the free market. And I think that, you know, a functioning government with a functioning political discourse would have had a conversation over 30 years about what was happening and whether it was good or bad for the long-term health of the democracy, which is more important.
Right. Just to push a little harder, I mean, so you say outsourcing is neither good nor bad intrinsically. I mean, couldn't someone just say, well, why not do tons of outsourcing, but have the government step in and just make sure that the gains from that outsourcing, the, you know, efficiency gains get redistributed more equitably throughout society? So instead of the extra, you know, 30 million that comes from shipping jobs overseas, we, you know, instead of that all going to CEOs, we tax the CEOs like hell and give it to the people who've lost their jobs, say. Like, what? Why would that be bad? Or would it be bad?
I don't think that's an economy that you and I would want to necessarily exist in. You know, I don't think that a purely redistributionist economy is going to be fun for anyone, whether that's capital, labor, or reporters in Washington. So I think that, you know, there is a view, and it's one that I have, that, you know, you would trade a little bit less efficiency for rewarding and prosperous middle-class jobs that support American families, that support income mobility, and that support a vibrant middle class. And then if you define that as an end state, then you would look at outsourcing and find it in most times to be problematic.
There's an example you give in one of your pieces that you might be able to reconstruct better, but it involves, you know, a pension that allocates money to private equity funds, which in turn outsource jobs and sort of hollow out localities, even as the pensioner gets some amount of benefit. Could you maybe reconstruct that thought experiment a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. This is to be clear, a hypothetical scenario is a piece that I wrote for the American Compass blog. And, you know, the question was, what are America's pensions getting from private equity? Because I think it's important to note that the growth of private equity and the growth of, you know, finance in general is in large part driven by the thirst for pension, the thirst on the part of pension funds to achieve returns, because these are underfunded by the states and localities which they serve. And so what I did is I constructed a scenario where I said, you know, there is a pension fund, let's say in Iowa, and is the Iowa Teachers Pension Fund. And you have a teacher who contributes to this fund for decades. And given what teachers make, you know, there's likely not a large amount of savings that's waiting for that person in retirement. What they have is their pension. And that pension fund, the managers of that fund then take those dollars, they aggregate them with all the other teachers in Iowa, and they allocate them to various financial instruments. And a huge portion of that today is private equity. And so what I think is this, an interesting hypothetical is, like, you know, we never had a conversation as a society around whether it was a good thing or a bad thing to give our money to a group of people who viewed outsourcing as nominally and purely good. And so you right. could see a scenario where a teacher's dollars were contributed to a pension fund that then invested in a private equity fund that bought a company in that teacher's town that then outsourced all of those jobs to Southeast Asia, and right. Which would make that teacher's day-to-day existence and the local economy of that town materially worse over the long run. And so the scenario is designed to say, well, would you trade a few points of return on your pension fund to not have your local economy outsourced to Asia? And I think it's a really interesting thought experiment.
Yeah, I think, what strikes me about the thought experiment is there's one way you can run it, which is what you do, where it's from an individual's perspective, are you better off, all things considered, with all the jobs in your community being outsourced, even if you get, you know, a slightly higher return? And that's one question. As I was reading it, it occurred to me that there's maybe a tougher thought experiment, which is, let's say that the return on the pension was actually really, really good, right? And so instead of it just being a few points, it, like, you know, it doubles or even triples your pension. Just, I know that's not realistic economically, but just suppose it were the case. I mean, is there also a sense in which private equity and outsourcing, part of the problem here is that it creates these perverse incentives where you actually will benefit in some way, right? You will get a higher pension if there's outsourcing. It creates, there's an individual benefit, but then a communal harm, right? Like, it seems like in some ways, what you're describing, you frame it as everyone's worse off, but you could also imagine a scenario in which the financialization of the economy just, it just increases the amount of zero-sum trade-offs people face and kind of undermines the sort of positive-sum logic that capitalism is supposed to have, right? Isn't that another way of looking at it, potentially?
I think so. I was laughing as you were going through your scenario because I was thinking of a study I read recently that, like, inherent in your assumptions are that private equity delivers a superior return.
And right.
It's actually
right.
increasingly in question, which is funny. But right. yeah, in the scenario you paint, the world is bleak.
Right. It's interesting because many of the defenders of private equity, I think the most sort of uncritical ones, often will in the same breath say, and capitalism's great because, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. But yeah, I mean, it seems to me that implicit in a lot of your arguments is a sense that the logic of financialization sort of pits different interests against each other. And obviously there's always going to be some zero-sum trade-offs. You can never totally eliminate those. But, the picture of private equity you paint is not one in which trade-offs become less salient. It seems like they become more salient and often more painful, and we choose sort of the more painful of the trade-off set. That was sort of my impression from your broader corpus.
Yeah. I think that is the an astute observation, Aaron. And I think I would actually segment, and I think this is important as finance and private equity and hedge funds gain more focus in the press. You know, I'd actually segment for the listener the industry in two ways. You know, one is by size, right? You have these massive private equity funds that, you know, they can deploy $1 billion into a single investment. And you have a whole smattering of smaller investment shops that are buying and investing in smaller companies. And so that's one lens I think that's useful in thinking about private equity and distinguishing between the landscape there. The other and the more important one is, like, the use of debt. Like, that's the key giveaway
yeah.
in trying to understand if an investor is engaging in something productive or not. And how much a business grows when after it's invested in is the other. So when investors you know, private equity, hedge funds, like whoever, investors writ large, when they buy a business and they grow it, that at a high level, that's going to stimulate the flywheel of capitalism. I think that's important. When investors buy a business with someone else's money, they use the company's profits to pay off the lender. They cut headcount. They cut costs to get the business producing more cash. Like, you just don't get the same productive energies from that endeavor. Mm-hmm. And then when you do that thousands of times a year for a couple of decades, well, like, what you get is the, you know, modern post-private equity American economy.
Right.
You know, financial engineering has gone into overdrive. But I would make that distinction. I think it's important because, you know, as the critiques of private equity gain steam on both the left and the right, like, just generic critiques of private equity and finance are going to go nowhere. And you have to be right. You have to be able to distinguish what's productive and what's not. And that's a subjective discourse. And I just gave you my view. But I think distinguishing is important.
And so it does seem like, you know, empirically, the reason that there is this kind of zero sum logic kicking in is because it's not so much, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like you're not necessarily critiquing financialization qua financialization. You're critiquing the substitution of finance for other productive activities, right? That's really the claim. It's not just that there's more and more finance, or even that it's a higher share of GDP. It's that there's actively less of the productive stuff, and that finance kind of is a mechanism sometimes with all these complicated, you know, financial instruments. It can be a mechanism that either lowers productivity or just sort of justifies people not really trying as hard as they might to increase it. Is that sort of a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think that lands well.
And it seems like, you know, you also sort of are talking about the kind of sort of self-interested, you know, almost gluttonous, frankly, culture that, you know, the financial sector has sort of evolved. And you say at one point that business schools have a role to play in correcting this by changing their admissions policies. And I want to read a line that stood out to me from your American Affairs essay. You say, deans who are unwilling to address the lack of geographic and industrial diversity among their graduates are unworthy of leading institutions that exert an outsized impact on the shape of commercial activity. So are you in some sense making a kind of subtle, almost Straussian case for affirmative action for the sake of the economy? Some kind of geographic affirmative action?
You know, I don't think so. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. You know, that what that line is the result of is attending business school and seeing, you know, what looks superficially and what is from a, you know, from a racial and a gender standpoint, a tremendously diverse place, which is good, which is a good thing. And then when you start talking to people, you realize that, you know, but behind that, you know, is a lot of people who spent their 20s at like three consulting firms and four banks.
Right.
I'm being tongue in cheek, but, you know, so like there's a lack of economic diversity in terms of people coming from industry, people coming from real working and middle class backgrounds. And so, you know, I'm not necessarily calling for an affirmative action in that regard. I'm saying if I were the dean of an elite business school, right, of any elite graduate school, whether it's law school, business school, you name it, like, and this I think is the central conceit of the American, you know, business class, is that they love to pretend that class distinctions don't exist. That's what the meritocracy papers over.
Right.
It ripples through corporate America, where, you know, people love to paper over what's happened to labor, what's happened to the working class. And you spend far more time talking about impact investing and environmental and social and governance metrics and board diversity, mm-hmm, without talking about, you know, what we've done to the economy and what we've done to the working class. And so, you know, I think my point in writing that was, you know, like, I'm, you know, sitting in the shoes of a dean of Stanford, you know, Graduate School of Business or Wharton or Harvard, you know, you're, like the people that you admit there and the opportunities that you give them, like you can really change not just their lives, but the trajectory of the economy. And I think you have a duty as one of those people to admit the most talented people you can find from industry.
So it's the most talented people subject to the constraint that they are from fields or plan to go into fields that will actually be productive.
I think that's right.
I guess so. One question. I mean, I don't know the culture well, but I went to an Ivy League school undergrad, and sort of the stereotype was that all these bright eyed kids would come in saying, "Oh, we want to go change the world and do all this great stuff." And then it was after they got there, right, that they went into finance and consulting. And so how do you sort of make sure that even if you do the admissions policy right, you have geographic diversity, you have people, everyone on their form says, I want to, you know, start a company and I don't want to go into finance. How do you sort of make sure that the school doesn't sort of persuade them while they're there to go into finance? How do you kind of prevent that from happening?
Yeah. I mean, I think this was the, you know, this was the crux, I think, of the American Affairs piece. I think a lot of your culture, whether you're talking about, you know, your undergrad experience or a graduate school or an organization like the military, who you hold out as heroes says a lot about you. It says a lot about your culture. There is a real opportunity to adjust for our young business leaders who their role models are. Because right now they're financiers.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a powerful way to change the environment and change the dynamic such that you're exposed to people who built companies. You're exposed to people who conducted, you know, who drove like really impressive physical innovation. And I think that could be really, really powerful.
So Sam, in your piece, you mention several figures who you hold up either as kinds of role models for finance or as villains who should not be emulated and who have been emulated to the detriment of Americans. Could you maybe talk about that a bit?
Yeah. I think the piece specifically talks about a hedge fund manager named Seth Klarman. And what's interesting about Klarman is that, you know, he graduated from HBS in 1982, which is a famous class for the school. It's the class that gave the American economy, in addition to Klarman, Jamie Dimon, Jeff Immelt, who oversaw the financialization of General Electric, Steve Mandel, who's another really famous hedge fund financier. These are men who created immense wealth and who built really substantial, financial funds. And what I did is I compared that class with the other most famous HBS class, which is the class of 1949. And there's just a stark difference, I think, in the culture of the two classes and in the way they made their money. The class of 1949 was also fantastically successful. But these are people who came out of the business school and led companies and rose to the ranks in corporations and were members of industry. And I found this book about the class. Like, someone went out of their way to write a whole book about the HBS class from 1949. It's called The Big Time, Harvard Business School's Most Successful Class and How It Shaped America. It's by a guy named Larry Shames. And I'll read an excerpt because I think it's really interesting. And he's talking about the students in the class of 49 right here. 78% of the class attended with the help of GI benefits. And many of those would never have seen the inside of Harvard had the Japanese not attacked Pearl Harbor. They were the sons of salesmen and farmers and bookkeepers. They came from inner city public schools and second tier Midwestern land grant colleges. And they'd grown up in households where aunts and union member uncles still spoke Polish or Yiddish or Italian or Greek. They'd been outsiders before the war, but now, having put in their time and let themselves be shot at, like everybody else, they were not to be denied a share in the rewards. They had no family firms to slide into, no pre-established networks of mentors to usher them along. What they did have, though, was the opportunity to try to make it on their own. And in the name of that unprecedented chance, they brought to the business school an almost hysterical intensity of effort that the blithe pre-war preppies would have found eccentric, unbecoming, and terrifying, end quote. And I think it's just a really interesting juxtaposition of not just the folks who inhabit business schools, but, you know, these members of the class of 49 juxtaposed against, you know, sort of, Aaron, to your point earlier, like the inhabitants of the Ivy League writ large and the inhabitants of the corporate elite writ large.
Yeah. It's telling to me that the most successful class was, it sounds like, largely not WASPs, right? It was not the white Anglo-Saxon upper class that had dominated for years and continued to dominate for several years after, you know, the 1940s. I mean, do you think that that's a coincidence? Like, well, like what do you think it was about the class that made them so successful?
Yeah, I think to your question earlier in our conversation, like it was a true meritocracy. Like it's when it worked.
Yeah.
You look at these folks, you know, 25 years later, and you know, one of them is this chairman of Xerox, which is one of the more impressive technology companies of that era. One of them was the chairman of Bloomingdale's. Another was the CEO of Johnson & Johnson. Another was leading Rahm & Haas. Like the list just goes on and on of the industries and the companies that these people led. And if you go back and you look at the class materials from the 40s and how the dean and the professors interact with the students, like these people, it's interesting that you brought up WASP because these people really had a sense of noblesse oblige. Like they really thought that their duty was to go out and yes, make money for themselves, but to do it in a way that, you know, created wealth for other people too.
Yeah, the variable here though, right, is there was just a world war that, you know, shaped the economic opportunities they had and perhaps also shaped the culture and the incentives, the sort of social incentives for them to go into certain fields and not others. But I mean, to what extent, I guess the question is to what extent was this an artifact of a very particular period in American history that we can't replicate without another world war? And to what extent was it the product of contingent, but nonetheless sort of shapeable and repeatable forces that we really could sort of recreate today?
Yeah, I think that, you know, and that this is a fairly philosophical and weighty question you ask. I think the war played a part in creating a set of conditions that don't need to be a one-off. Like, you know, we learned what worked, how to create a meritocracy that functions, how to teach people who are ambitious and talented, how to teach people what matters and how to invest not just in stocks, but in their communities and their neighbors, and to use their talents in really productive ways. I think that's what you see in the class of 49 is that these are men who knew they were talented and they were certainly ambitious, but they had guardrails on that ambition that channeled it into very productive places. Like, I don't think that is a function of the world.
Thank you for listening to the American Compass podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, please tell a friend and don't forget to subscribe. To learn more about American Compass and read our work, please visit americancompass.org.